This is the New England Journal of Medicine COVID-19 update for August 5th, 2020. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the journal, and I'm talking with Eric Rubin, editor-in-chief, Lindsay Baden, deputy editor, and a guest that we have with us today, Arnold Epstein, who's a health policy expert, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's also served in various federal government roles, most recently as deputy assistant secretary of Health and Human Services, and head of the Office of Health Policy. Arnie is a primary care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he's also for some time been an associate editor of the journal. Arnie, Lindsay, Eric, our podcasts to date have focused on COVID-19 itself, but there are plenty of other health problems going on, and all of them are being affected by the presence of this pandemic. This week, we published a study that gave us a chance to see how COVID-19 has affected healthcare in other areas during the height of the pandemic. What did this study tell us?
Steve, the study you're referring to looked at out-of-hospital cardiac arrests early in the course of the outbreak in the Lombardy region of Italy, which was a region that was very heavily affected by COVID-19. And this studied the period from mid-February until the end of March, which was pretty much the height of the epidemic. The investigators looked at registry information for cardiac arrests that occurred during that period and compared the incidents from 2020 back to the same period in 2019. And then they looked at other registries to determine how much of a role COVID-19 played in each one of these events. And to do this, they looked for recent or concurrent COVID-19 testing in the patients who presented in cardiac arrests or recent reports of compatible symptoms. What they found is that there was a substantial increase in the number of out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, up from about 229 in 2019 to 362 in this year, which represents an almost 60% increase. There were several other changes. Patients were more likely to have unwitnessed arrests in 2020 than in 2019, and less likely, therefore, to receive CPR. The cumulative incidence of cardiac arrests correlated strongly with the incidence of COVID-19. And of those who had cardiac arrest, 103 had known or suspected COVID-19. And that accounts for a substantial percentage of the total increase in cases, suggesting that a number of these patients had cardiac complications of their viral infections.
So this is an example where COVID-19 is contributing to the burden of cardiac disease in the community. What about the opposite? How many people are missing out on care because of the lack of access to healthcare, which has been created by the pandemic?
Well, I think this has been a huge issue, and it's entirely clear that not a lot of people are getting the care that they would ordinarily receive. It's difficult to determine what the numbers are behind that, but all the anecdotes point to a huge deficit in care. We published in June a story in a piece by Lisa Rosenbaum, which described several individuals who were either not receiving care or physicians who were not providing care that was really necessary, including cardiology patients who had essential services that were being deferred in the setting of acute illness, and a number of cancer patients who are opting for care that was not optimal because of either their concerns about COVID-19 or the lack of access to some of the services they would get ordinarily. And there are many, many factors contributing here. Some of it is simply that healthcare institutions weren't open for business because they were devoting their resources to the care of COVID-19 patients. And others are the patient's concerns about getting COVID-19 or the fact that they have to take public transportation to get to the hospital. And of course, this is all occurring in the face of financial crises, both for the hospitals and providers and for individuals.
Eric, I think you're right on target with this. There's no question that the direct clinical impact of COVID-19 has been tremendous, with more than 150,000 deaths in the U.S. alone. But that does not count the critical spillovers that have likely increased non-COVID deaths. As you point out, many patients were reluctant to risk using public transport or otherwise seek medical care in medical offices or hospitals where COVID-19 was likely to be present. Patients with chronic disease that benefit from close management, diabetes mellitus, congestive heart failure, COPD, and those with other such conditions went without monitoring or therapeutic adjustment that could have prevented important exacerbations. Patients with non-COVID illnesses treated as inpatients suffered shortfalls as well. Hospitals that were hard hit by high volumes of COVID-19 patients, often without adequate personal protective equipment, suffered from organizational spreads that likely led to differences in the speed and efficiency with which care could be delivered for non-COVID conditions. Maybe some of the largest adverse impacts were in skilled nursing facilities. Here, COVID was a direct problem, with more than 40% of COVID deaths in the U.S. coming from individuals residing in nursing homes. But in that setting, there is almost surely an uncounted toll among patients with non-COVID disease. In response to the pandemic, skilled nursing facilities imposed a number of measures to reduce the spread of COVID. This included closing the premises to all visitors, as well as eliminating communal dining and other activities. These measures imposed a level of isolation and surely increased stress for long-term residents, especially those who are frail or cognitively impaired. To make matters worse, shortfalls in personal protective equipment and materials for testing impeded effective infection control by SNF staff. Staffing itself also emerged as a major vulnerability. Shortages of staff due to illness or abandonment have been severe enough to require intervention from the National Guard in SNFs across the country. Collectively, these changes mean that even in SNFs without a COVID-19 outbreak, long-term residents face an extreme level of stress and isolation from the usual social contacts in the healthcare system.
Arnie, you bring up many different points there about some of the issues we have in a lot of our healthcare facilities. I wonder, how much of this do you think points out pre-existing problems with some of these institutions? For example, you were talking about nursing homes and SNFs at the end, and some have pointed out that infection control has long been a problem in these areas. And I know, Lindsay, you've thought about this as well.
Certainly, there's been a literature of people complaining about skilled nursing facilities and not being up to snuff and doing all they can. And indeed, there's a mandate out from Medicare, CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that came out just yesterday with attempts to regulate skilled nursing facilities and provide a series of crutches that will help them perform better.
I mean, I think it's important that we make a distinction between the direct complications of COVID and the indirect complications. And what I mean by that, Eric, is even though there were over 100 individuals in the study from Italy who had COVID with their cardiac arrest, I think we need to think carefully, is that due directly to COVID, or are the circumstances such where COVID unmasks underlying illness and then impacts the nature, timing, quality of the care that they get in an urgent fashion? And I think that translates to these other arenas. Because if it's directly due to COVID, then blocking transmission and novel therapies that can treat COVID become very important. If it's indirectly due to COVID, then we can think about strengthening other services that can mitigate the complications, such as other care. And I suspect that the indirect effects may be even greater than the direct effects in terms of the morbidity we're seeing in skilled nursing facilities and other facilities. And like influenza, which can unmask cardiac susceptibility, I suspect COVID is as well as other needs in the health sector. So I think the direct and indirect, at least in my mind, are different pathogenesis, and we have to think about the response differently.
I think that's a really good distinction, Lindsay. I can't speak to whether the cardiac problems that are described in the study that Eric described are due to myocarditis in some way or vasculitis in myocardial circulation. But I can tell you that we spend a lot of time as a healthcare system worried about the direct effects of COVID, and very little information exists about the indirect effects of COVID. And you've got, in this case, skilled nursing facilities that were really drawn away from their primary mission. And I would be surprised if the mortality rates in those skilled nursing facilities for non-COVID disease were not higher.
And the indirect effects are both in the acute complications, as you suggest, but I worry about the less acute, such as diabetes management, hypertension management, and even routine vaccinations, which are getting deferred widely. But we will not see those impacts for 6 months to a year or two or three, as potentially measles or other transmissible infections may not be as well controlled due to delayed, deferred, or missed opportunities to do routine healthcare.
Oh, and of course, among those vaccines is influenza. We're coming up on influenza season. And if people are missing out on their flu vaccines, we're going to have this very difficult situation where we have the concurrent epidemics of flu and COVID-19, which superficially resemble each other, and it's going to be very difficult to sort out.
I have not seen any research that takes a solid look at what the non-COVID death situation is in skilled nursing facilities. And I take your point that it may take a while for some of this to show up because it's chronic management, but these are very frail people. And I wouldn't be surprised if we look at the death rates during the heart of the first surge between early April and late May, where we don't see a substantial increase in non-COVID mortality.
I share your concern, Arnie, with 150,000 deaths in this country due to COVID that we know about. There's probably a substantial number we don't know about. And then all the indirect effects of COVID have not been systematically measured in any easily understandable way. And the impact of that is likely to be even larger than the direct effects of COVID.
Yeah, and I think that there's very good evidence for this. If you count the number of excess deaths, they're larger than can be accounted for by the number attributable to COVID-19. Now, some of that is undiagnosed COVID-19, probably, but a large part of it is probably exactly what you're referring to, Lindsay, effects on other healthcare.
Looking at the flip side, you talked about some areas that are being strengthened as a result of the pandemic. And for primary care providers, telehealth has played a big role. How's this working? And what are the prospects that telehealth is going to continue to be important after the outbreak is under control?
Telehealth has played a huge role in this pandemic. At the nadir in early April, visit rates to physicians were down to somewhere like 45 to 60% of where they had been. And at that point, we saw telehealth beginning to compensate, reducing the shortfall by somewhere between 15 percentage points and maybe half. Since then, overall visits have rebounded, although not back to the original length, and telehealth visits have declined somewhat. Because of the pandemic, Medicare and various states have liberalized the relations that govern and constrain telehealth. For example, right now, you don't have to have video. You can use a regular telephone for a telehealth visit. We're going to have to see what the policy landscape looks like when COVID finally clears.
Arnie, in your own practice, have you been using telehealth?
In my practice as a physician, I haven't, but as a patient, I have. And I've been amazed at what one can do with a telehealth visit. You can't get laboratory and you can't get biopsies. So those are the limitations. But if you don't need those two, a lot can be done through a telehealth visit, more than I would have expected.
So, Arnie, what are the barriers to telehealth being maintained, enhanced in our routine care?
Well, there are a series of regulations that have hampered telehealth in the past. For example, Medicare reimburses only into rural areas. Medicare does not reimburse for just telephone. But we're going to see potential changes in those. We have on a transient basis here seen some differences that the government has let through and made an exception for, and some of them may continue on in the future.
Because I know in my own practice, I've found telehealth virtual visits to be incredibly valuable, particularly for my patients who travel long distances or have limited mobility. And it allows much better follow-up since a lot of information can be communicated and plans appropriately altered without the need for a blood test. And often that can be obtained through visiting nurses or other more convenient structures to our more fragile patients.
The story you're telling is typical for doctors who find telehealth to be a huge adjunct to the regular communication they can have with their patients. The issue for Medicare is concern about excess spending that will create visits that telehealth visits will be additive rather than substitutes. and that the additive was low yield, low value care. An example might be a doctor sees a patient as an inpatient and then calls him or her on the phone later in the day and says, everything going okay? That's arguably a visit that they might have gotten by without. And so there has that big concern, and the regulations are really aimed at that.
You've been talking about the deferral of care for many patients, something that clearly puts them at risk for complications from their illnesses. But it also means that there are fewer visits to physicians, fewer visits to hospitals. So what are the consequences of this for the economics of healthcare?
The disruption in healthcare has taken a huge toll in the healthcare industry. In early April, at the peak of the initial surge, revenue in physicians' offices were down perhaps 60%. While it's rebounding now from that low, it has still not come back to normal. Hospitals were under particular stress. They were forced to deal with heretofore unknown infectious illness that imposed enormous demands for specialized care, overtaxing those institutions. On the other hand, they faced extraordinary declines in demand for more routine services, and particularly elective surgery, which are an economic staple. The accounts I've seen predict that hospitals will lose more than $300 billion in 2020, and employment in the healthcare system is down by more than a million jobs.
These are dire numbers, Arnie. How many healthcare institutions are not going to survive this?
I think there's concern that a lot of practices of physicians will not survive in their present form. Now, there's been a rebound, and it's come back, and maybe that's premature, but certainly early on, there was that major concern that they might not survive. And you can see the duress in hospitals. Our local institution, Brigham and Women's Hospital, as you know, is with partners, has canceled benefits for its staff physicians and staff. No retirement contributions this year. So there is clearly duress.
And I guess I'm particularly thinking about rural hospitals where they're sole providers, and a lot of these institutions were not in great financial shape before this happened. Are we going to be losing some of our hospitals as well?
So I would think that the government is going to act sharply, and already has to some extent with bailouts, to funnel money into the hospital industry and try and assure access. Certainly, the rural lobbies have been very effective through the years in protecting access to small hospitals in rural areas.
So you've talked about two potential long-term effects of the outbreak on healthcare. We've talked about telehealth and about the possibility of closures and loss of jobs. There and beyond, how do you see things looking 2 years from now? How different will the U.S. healthcare system look?
Maybe very different. Some of this may depend on the shape of Congress and the presidential election. The pandemic has set in relief several important fault lines. First, the overall fall in employment has echoed into substantially increased numbers of persons who are uninsured or on Medicaid. Second, the vulnerabilities of disadvantaged populations and minorities have been striking. And third, the shortfall of the public health system is undeniable. We have 4% of the world's population and approximately 25% of the world's COVID cases and deaths. We've had shortages in testing that still persist. And early on, we had lack of coordination and problems in leadership, which persist as well today. If there is a new administration in Washington, I would imagine concerted efforts to reduce the impact of these three problems. On the insurance side, that may mean greater subsidies to the marketplace and increased efforts to expand Medicaid. Concern about racial and ethnic disparities may evolve into greater support for safety net facilities and community providers. Whether this results in legislation to give the federal government more responsibility and more power over public health is unclear.
You know, one of the striking stresses that's been clear is when there's an economic shock to the entire overall economy that's induced by a medical crisis like this, it brings into sharp focus the issue of the linkage between employment and insurance. There's sort of a double whammy where people are out of work, but their insurance, which is required to respond to the epidemic, is tied to those jobs that they no longer have. That certainly is a unique issue in a crisis like this.
It is, Eric. And as most people know, about 60% of the American public gets their insurance from employers. So when you lose your job often your insurance is threatened and you lose it. And I think this experience here with both losing jobs and employment, the employment rate going down substantially, and then people losing jobs as a result, will not be without leading people to think about maybe they ought to think once again about changing the actual insurance system in this country. When push comes to shove, Americans are generally loath to take such big actions, but this will be on the table.
So, Ernie, I guess the big question is the whole healthcare system going to look different as a result of what's happening right now? And I know you can't predict, but I'm going to ask you to predict. Are there likely to be changes, or are we so comfortable with what we had before that the American public is going to be comfortable going back to it?
I don't think we're going completely back to it. There's controversy in the healthcare system among the pundits about this. The head of Medicare and Medicaid Services, Seema Verma, said we are not going back in those flat terms. And I think in certain ways she's almost surely right. Telehealth is not going to go back to normal. But I think people have learned that in certain instances, it can be a useful adjunct to care, certainly from the doctor's side, but from the patient's side, it means not going down to Brigham and Women's Hospital and spending $20 on parking and a half hour each way on transport when it was a routine visit and so forth. And I think you'll see innovation come into the healthcare sector where you'll see closer for diabetics, closer glucose monitoring at home, and programs that will let doctors make adjustments in someone's glucose treatment much more easily than they have thus far. So I think we're not going back to where we've been. The interesting part of this for me is also that COVID, unlike most diseases, has focused my attention and our attention on spillovers. As awful as the direct effects of COVID have been, I think there may be a hidden underbelly problem. And we're going to see doctors pay attention to that going forward.
Thank you, Arnie. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Lindsay.